And then it will be at that point that the Muslim nations that surround Israel will at least have some bargaining power to compel Israel to accept the Palestinians, accept a Palestinian state, and not continue to engage in this policy of genocide, which they're going to follow whether it's Netanyahu or Benny Gantz.
All right, and on that note, I thank both of you for being with me on this spotlight. Larry Johnson, former CIA analyst out of Moscow. Christopher Halali, research and political analyst out of Vermont. And thank you for being with us on another spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now we enlighten you with Ayah 260 to 263 of Surah Baqarah, recited by Shahriyar Parhizgar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Wa idh qala Ibrahim rabbi arini kayfa tuhyil mauta qala awalam tu'min qala bala walakin liyatma'inna qalbi قال فخذ أربعة من الطير فصرهن إليك ثم اجعل على كل جبل منهن جزءا ثم ادعهن يأتينك سعيا واعلم أن الله عزيز حكيم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة 100 حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون قول معروف ومغفرة خير من صدقة يتبعها أذى والله غني حليم.
In the name of Allah, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. And when Abraham said, My Lord, show me how you revive the dead. He said, Do you not believe? He said, Yes indeed, but in order that my heart may be at rest. He said, Take four of the birds, then cut them into pieces, and place a part of them on every mountain. Then call them, they will come to you, hastening. And know that Allah is Almighty and All-Wise. Those who spend their wealth in the way of Allah and then do not follow what they have spent with reproaches and affronts, they shall have their reward near their Lord, and they will have no fear, nor will they grieve. An honorable word with pardon is better than a charity followed by affront, and Allah is all-sufficient, most forbearing.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
With U.S. genocide in Gaza now close to its entering its sixth month, death toll surpasses 30,200, majority of them women and children. Resistance fighters in Gaza continue to engage Israeli occupation forces, inflicting significant casualties on invading troops. And following Iranian elections for parliament and assembly of experts, attention now focuses on the outcome as vote counting is underway. Israel's genocidal campaign in Gaza continues with scores of Palestinians killed and hundreds injured over the last 24 hours. In the latest attacks, Israeli forces targeted Al-Zaytun neighborhood of Gaza City, that's in the center of the besieged strip, killing several civilians and leaving many others injured. The regime forces also launched strikes on southern cities of Rafah and Khan Yunis. Israeli attacks have also been claiming the lives of captives held in Gaza. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says seven captives were killed as a direct result of recent Israeli attacks, including three who were shot dead. The death toll from the Israeli onslaught on Gaza since October the 7th has now surpassed 30,200, and more than 71,300 people have also been injured. According to Gaza's health ministry, at least 13 children have also starved to death in the besieged enclave in recent days. The World Health Organization described this as a very sad threshold.
A very sad threshold, similar sad as the 30,000 deaths we reached all over Gaza. And similar like those, these are official records. And as you all point out, exactly, the unofficial numbers can unfortunately be expected to be higher. And once we see them registered in hospitals, once we see them registered officially, it's already further down the line. The system in Gaza is, well, we said it many times, it's on its knees, it's more than on its knees. The fresh water supply has been cut off since immediately after 7 October. The electricity has been cut off since immediately after the horrifying attacks of the 7th of October. All the lifelines in Gaza have more or less been cut. So, and all this leads to a desperate situation, as we saw yesterday in the unfortunate, horrifying incidents where hundreds of people got killed. While there's a while the Secretary General mentioned exactly that an investigation should show what the real causes were, that's not even right now important. Important is that people are so desperate for food, for fresh water, for any supplies, that they risk their lives in getting any food, any supplies to support their children, to support themselves. This is the real drama. This is the real catastrophe here. That food and supplies are so scarce that we see these situations coming up. And the food supplies have been cut off deliberately. Let's not forget that. We saw pictures from Al-Shifa where victims of the attacks, of the horrifying situation yesterday, of the killings, were lying next to each other on the floor awaiting any type of treatment. This is the real drama here. And that is why, despite to the calls now that this may delay the ceasefire, this just underlines more and more that we need an urgent, urgent ceasefire now. If not now, when then?
And joining us now from Deir al-Balah in the besieged Gaza Strip is Moti Abu Musabe for the latest on the ground there. Hello, Moti. Hope you are safe. What can you tell us this morning?
Well, actually, the Israeli occupation forces committed a telling massacre over the last night here in Deir al-Balah city after destroying and targeting at least 3 residential buildings in the central of Deir al-Balah and in the eastern part of Deir al-Balah, claiming the lives of at least 22 Palestinian civilians, mostly women and children. They were attacked and killed as they were sleeping inside their houses. In addition to that, the artillery maintained its shelling at the eastern part of the city, while in Al-Nusayrat refugee camp, particularly the northern part of that camp, the Israeli artillery maintained targeting that area. In addition to dozens of the Palestinian houses and residential buildings were destroyed and blown up by the Israeli occupation forces using the explosive devices there. It's noteworthy that in Khan Yunis city, also the Israeli occupation forces renewed their attacks against the western part of Khan Yunis city. The Israeli artillery intensified and concentrated its attacks against that area, targeting several residential buildings there. While the eastern parts of the same city, Khan Yunis city, witnessed destroying and targeting several residential buildings, and they were also blasted using the explosive devices. When it comes to the northern part of Gaza Strip, particularly Jabalia refugee camp and Beit Lahia and Beit Hanun, they were subjected to intense Israeli attacks using the Israeli warplanes. Several residential buildings were destroyed and flattened using the consecutive Israeli airstrikes. In addition to that, the Israeli artillery also maintained its shelling towards those areas. And even in Gaza City, more Palestinian residential buildings were attacked by the Israeli artillery and the Israeli airstrikes in a Zaytun neighborhood, claiming the lives of multiple of Palestinian civilians there. In the meantime, it's worth mentioning that the Israeli occupation forces are still using starvation as a weapon of war against the Palestinian people, taking more lives of the Palestinian children in Gaza Strip. The number of the Palestinian children who have been killed since over the last couple of days actually amounted to 13 Palestinian children. 13 Palestinian children were killed in a cold blood by the Israeli occupation forces as they were deprived of having the food and clean drinkable water, causing them a malnutrition and a dehydration. And this number is highly expected to rise exponentially as thousands of the Palestinian children are living the same circumstances of deprivation of the needed humanitarian needs and assistance and the needed medical care. We are talking about catastrophic and beyond catastrophic humanitarian conditions. Over to you.
And Moti, is there any plan? I mean, does UNRWA or any other aid organization or any countries for that matter, do they have the power to try to push aid through to prevent child death from malnutrition. You said there's been almost a couple handful of children, and this is expected to rise. Is there a solution in the near future to prevent this from happening?
Yes, actually, the need for the people here is very dire. And having this sporadic humanitarian aid allowed into Gaza or dropped in on Gaza Strip actually means nothing compared to the dire need that the Palestinian people are living and experiencing, particularly when it comes to the children. What Gaza Strip really needs these moments is the flow, the continuous flow of the humanitarian aid into Gaza Strip. And this actually needs a real political willingness from the regional parties. They need to oblige the Israeli occupation to allow the entry of those humanitarian aid into Gaza Strip without having any restrictions, without targeting those humanitarian aid, and without procrastinating the allowing those aid to enter to Gaza Strip. Till this moment, and even despite all these talks about allowing some humanitarian aid to enter Gaza Strip, I mean that the need is overwhelming for the people here, and we need continuous flow of those and supply flow of those humanitarian aid and assistance to enter into Gaza Strip without any restrictions.
Okay, Moti, stay safe. We'll talk to you soon. Moti Abu joining us from Deir al-Balah. Meanwhile, intense battles are also continuing on the ground in Gaza, with Palestinian resistance fighters repelling attacks by Israeli forces. The military wing of Islamic Jihad released a video showing its fighters clashing with Israeli soldiers in and around Al-Zaytun neighborhood in Gaza City. The Al-Quds brigades also launched mortar shells at a gathering of regime soldiers in northern Gaza. Also in the north, the Mujahideen brigades hit a Merkava tank with missiles. Resistance groups also say they shot down an Israeli drone in the southwestern part of the besieged enclave. The regime in Tel Aviv says a total of 242 of its soldiers have been killed since ground fighting began in late October. The Palestinian resistance groups, however, say that Israel is concealing the actual number, which they say is much higher. And since Israel launched its genocidal war on Gaza in early October, it spared no one and no place, including homes, hospitals, schools, and mosques. In an act of defiance and resistance, though, Palestinians in the southern city of Rafah have been holding Friday prayers over the ruins of one such mosque, the Al-Faruq.
This is an ideological war that affects many mosques and hospitals. Why destroy and bomb houses of God? What is the fault of the children who are orphaned in the face of this destruction and organized terrorism, covered by official international endorsement from states and from the West? These mosques refuse to be silenced, and the call to prayer will continue to resound, growing louder. Despite this occupier and their arrogance, we must uphold God's rituals and continue to hold Friday prayers in this place.
Our message to the entire Islamic nation is to look at the condition of Muslims and the state of the mosques in the Gaza Strip. The occupation may have destroyed nearly 500 mosques or more. Now, out of 1,250 mosques in the Gaza Strip, almost half have been destroyed by the occupation. Our message to the Islamic and Arab nations is that they must include these mosques in their future plans so that we can rebuild the houses of God and hold prayers, Friday prayers, and congregational prayers in them, and tease the enemies to establish mosques again.
We pray in this place because I opened my eyes to this mosque since I was young. At the age of 6, I used to pray in this mosque. We're residents of this area. The mosque is not even 200 meters from my house, and we have prayed in it all our lives, even when it was bombed. It is not enough for them to destroy the morale of the Palestinian people, demolish homes, kill people, and wipe out entire families. But this is not just the goal of the Israeli aggression on mosques. Rather, the goal is to prevent the spread of religion and Islamic awareness among the people.
A Palestinian injured when aid trucks entered Gaza on Thursday evening. Say Israeli forces shot them as they rushed to get food for their families. Here's an account of incident by some of the wounded.
When the 8 trucks arrived, I went there, and then the tank and the drone began to fire. I got injured in the back, and I was bleeding for an hour until someone from my relatives came and took me to the hospital.
We were in Al Rashid Road waiting for 8. At 3:30, they started firing shells and shooting at people. We were on the beach. My son ran to the beach and they shot him twice. One grazed his head and the other in his chest.
We are very hungry. We don't have food or anything. They fired shells at us. They attacked us. They squashed us. They shot at us. There is no food. There is nothing. We want flour to eat. They shot the little ones. They humiliated us. They threw gas at us.
Now polls closed in Iran's key elections for parliament and the assembly of experts after voting hours were extended 3 times. Process of vote counting has already begun and initial results are expected out in the coming hours. In the elections, 290 parliamentary seats were up for grabs. Elected candidates will serve parliament for 4 years, and voters also cast ballots for 88 seats of the assembly of experts, which is a deliberative body elected for 8 years. More than 61 million Iranians were eligible to vote in both elections. Meanwhile, voters have expressed their unwavering support for the Islamic Revolution by actively participating in the elections. Iranians say they deeply believe in the power of their collective voice and the democratic processes in the Islamic Republic. Let's take a listen to what some had to say.
With our votes, we want to show that despite problems and deficiencies in the country's governance, the people are wholeheartedly supporting the revolution, their national interests, and their country.
We have to fulfill our duty to the extent we can. Yes, there are many problems, too many problems. We're sad and we voice our criticism as much as we can. God willing, those responsible will think about them and probably many of them do care.
I feel that the participation is much better than last time and in my opinion, people are optimistic about the elections.
With all the propaganda that hostile media made, I think the turnout would be higher than the previous round.
And Iran's Constitutional Council has the important role of overseeing the electoral process and confirming the final results of the elections. Our correspondent, Kisumish Ahmadi, earlier spoke to the spokesperson of that very council at a polling station in Tehran.
We witnessed the voting of our people from the very early hours. And as you can see, in midday, we see such great crowds here. And this shows that people deem it important to use their right. The future of the country is important to them. The future of themselves and their children are important to them. Thank God that there's been no problem since the beginning of voting, and everything has been smooth and facilitated, and people are casting their ballots in the two parliamentary elections and the Assembly of Experts elections. Since the morning, we've been overseeing the elections. We have not seen any special irregularity since the morning. Some minor issues have been removed. We have not had any special problem. As well as the 230,000 public supervisors, we have also introduced a system so that all the 80 million population of Iran can supervise the election. So if there is any potential irregularity, they could document it for us.
Thanks for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
When the whole world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust. From the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps. From the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord and Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee, and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O, the Most Merciful.
The Limelight.
Palestinian coalition has called for total energy embargo on the Zionist regime. The group is calling for trade unionists, environmental groups, and human rights organizations to stop fuel exports to Israel. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East Oil Roads, a coalition of Palestinian organizations, has called for a total energy embargo on the Zionist regime until it holds its war on the Gaza Strip. Launched recently, the Global Energy Embargo has called for organizations, workers, and environmental activists to stop all energy exports to Israel until it puts an end to the genocide and its regime of apartheid and ethnic cleansing against the Palestinian people. The campaign is working with a team of researchers to analyze energy flows to Israel and identify choke points in its supply chain. In addition to halting fuel imports, the coalition is also demanding an end to the Zionist regime's gas exports to Europe. Citing the Zionist regime's continuing impunity following the International Court of Justice ruling to proceed with South Africa's case charging the regime with genocide, a coalition spokesperson told Middle East Eye, "We are currently at a time where it takes more than just an ICJ ruling to actually enforce the kind of measures we need." The campaign builds on obvious calls from the Palestine General Federation of Trade Unions, PGFTU, to stop arming the Zionist regime. The fabricated regime of Israel, with almost no domestic crude oil production last year, imported around 300,000 barrels per day of crude. Israel's biggest source of oil is from the Republic of Azerbaijan, with $300 million imported in January. The crude exports are shipped from Turkey's Mediterranean port of Ceyhan. Charlotte Rose, a researcher from the campaign group Disrupt Power, a member of the coalition, told MEE, "At a state level, there are concerns around the infeasibility of an energy embargo because of the way the U.S. would support supply in other areas. But what we are trying to show through research and work with different movements is what that can look like from below." The coalition is working with an expanding global network of workers and campaign groups to target fuel exports to Israel, including mine workers in Colombia, the largest exporter of coal to Israel. In a statement, the workers highlighted the link between the export of metals, minerals, and fuels to Israel and the Zionist regime's role in providing training and equipment to paramilitaries responsible for murdering trade unionists. In the United States, the coalition has connected with the campaign group Chevron Out of Palestine, who staged a 500-strong rally outside the company's refinery. According to the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement, the fossil fuel giant is the main international actor extracting fossil gas claimed by the Zionist regime in Eastern Mediterranean. The coalition is also working with journalists and climate groups in Europe to raise awareness around the Zionist regime's gas exports into the EU, which has become a major importer of the Zionist regime's gas to plug shortages left after the Russia-Ukraine crisis. Following the stalled construction of the Eastern Mediterranean pipeline, which would connect the EU gas network with reserves in the Eastern Mediterranean, including some in offshore Israel, the EU turned to shipping the Zionist regime's gas from Egyptian terminals. The imports have continued through the Zionist regime's ongoing assault on Gaza, with Bloomberg reporting that two liquefied natural gas LNG vessels left Egypt and docked in Belgium and Italy in October. Rose told MEE, "The EU was receiving gas through the genocide. This is through a series of pipeline infrastructures that have been set up over the last decade between Egypt and Israel and then transported to European terminals. In June 2022, the EU, Egypt, and the Zionist regime signed a memorandum of understanding to allow significant exports of Israeli gas to Europe and to encourage EU companies to invest in the Zionist regime's gas fields. In 2023, the fabricated regime of Israel awarded gas exploration licenses to Italy's Eni, British Petroleum, and Dana Petroleum to explore for natural gas off the regime's Mediterranean coast. Rose told MEE, "Without this kind of support and without this idea of Israel becoming a form of diversification for the EU gas problem, it wouldn't really have political and financial power that it does. The EU movement is really behind on that, whether it's the climate movement or other social movements. That's why we started doing this scoping exercise and mobilizing to push groups to be more vocal on this."
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Over 100,000 people have been killed or wounded in Gaza since October last year. That's about one in every 20 man, woman and child in the besieged enclave dead or injured. This is Gaza Under Attack with me, Amina Taylor. Welcome back. The death toll continues to rise after occupation forces killed at least 100 people who were waiting for humanitarian aid in Gaza City. Doctors report a further 150 were injured in the same attack in the Nablusi area in the west of Gaza. In a sign of continuing settlement expansion, the apartheid regime has appropriated 650 acres of Palestinian land, now designating it a part of Male Adamum settlement east of Jerusalem al-Quds. Dozens of UK-based journalists have signed an open letter to the Egyptian and Israeli embassies to allow unfettered access into Gaza and better protection for journalists already working there. In January, Israel's Supreme Court rejected a request from international media citing safety concerns. Meanwhile, in England, voting has opened in the first polls that may well punish both the ruling Conservatives and opposition Labour parties for their pro-genocide stance as pro-Palestine candidates look set to triumph. The US-Israeli bombing of Gaza continues at pace. Since October last year, 30,000 Palestinians have been killed, most of them women and children. So much to get through and helping me to do just that for this edition of the program. In the studio with me, a welcome return for Charles Kelly. Charles is an author and a finance podcaster, host of the wonderful Money Tips. And joining us via Skype from Sheffield is holistic transformational life coach Uzma Naqvi. Welcome back to both of you. Uzma, I want to start with you here because I think it's so heartbreaking to see the suffering that's been heaped on the Palestinians inside Gaza already. And we know whatever happens, Uzma, this trauma will linger, will it not?
It most definitely will. Thank you so much for having me again. And most likely for the rest of their lives and into their future generations, true, very, very sadly. This is not a trauma that we discussed in general terms and normal terms when we talk about trauma. This is not something that's just happening at a subconscious level and then we have to deal with the emotional triggers that come as a result of it. That's what we normally talk about when we talk about trauma as well. This is a man-made trauma to an unprecedented extent that absolutely can, should never have taken place. It could have been prevented. And, you know, these kids, if we're just talking about what's happening right now, they haven't eaten for weeks. They haven't slept in months. They are constantly petrified for the next bomb to land in their tents. They're having intense adrenaline rush to the point where that's leading them to a cardiac arrest. And I'm talking about children age five, even younger, sometimes having heart attacks. The amount of fear that is running through their little bodies and their minds is unspeakable. There are children that are telling doctors that they would rather die than to exist in the way that they're existing right now. Now, there are children that have been rescued from under the rubble who no longer speak. They're in such a state of shock that they've lost the ability to communicate anymore, you know, and there are children that are found under the rubble for hours. They just watch their dead siblings lying just right next to them with, you know, burnt out limbs. And these are children that are malnourished. They've been, they have been several deaths already that have happened because of starvation in North Gaza. And it's just a horrific, the endless amount of circumstances. If they survive from bombs, if they're lucky enough to get out of under the rubble, they're having their limbs amputated without anesthesia. So, you know, on top of all of that, they no longer have any surviving members of the family to comfort them. So it's absolutely devastating situation that is absolutely going to live with them for a very, very long time. And there'll be a lot of work that needs to be done to help them, to support them, to come out of what they are going through right now.
Devastating picture, yet a harshly realistic one you pose, Uzma. But Charles, I saw you nodding there as she described some of the realities on the ground, which means a ceasefire is more urgent, more necessary than ever. Are you optimistic? President Joe Biden said we might have had one by Monday. Monday is approaching.
Yes, I saw that interview where he was eating an ice cream. It looks
the
so flippant.
Optics were
yeah,
poor,
it
yes.
wasn't the right way to come across, but I don't know. I mean, when they talk to either sides, they don't seem ready for a ceasefire yet. So personally, I'm not that optimistic, but you never know. They can do these late last minute talks and get something, but it's definitely needed. I mean, as Uzma said, it's more than just a trauma. It's like a humanitarian crisis. And, you know, while politicians are talking, people are dying.
They are indeed. Now, Uzma, I know your line of specialism here is for the body, the spirit, the soul. But outside of that, just your thoughts on there being calls for a cultural and maybe a sporting boycott in the same vein that was witnessed with South Africa during its apartheid era. Do you think that might have an impact if people perhaps made Israel into that pariah state, that pariah entity?
I really do. I'm very hopeful. Even to the question you posed to your guest about ceasefire. I if there's no hope, what is there? You know, I lack words now to describe what's going on and how to even verbalize what's going on. But we have to have faith. We have to have hope in what's going on. And I really do think that we've entered into maybe this is a bit too optimistic, but that's the way I like to think about things, that we've entered into the phase of the beginning of the end of this oppression. It's gone on far too long. It will still take a long, long time and absolutely nothing will happen overnight. But the credibility that's been lost over this genocide will never, ever be restored in the way that it was before. And that gives me hope.
Charles, we like to get your financial hat on there, the economist in you. And we know that all of these incursions have a cost. I'm speaking more for the UK, the US, that's pumped billions into the situation in the Middle East. And, of course, Israel itself, that's lost tourism, people are out of work, people are afraid to go back to some of those settlement areas. Your analysis of that section?
No, I agree with you. The tourism is down. It plays a fairly large part of their GDP. But the cost of war is enormous. I mean, one of the main costs is the debt that's rising. Wars are usually financed by debt. America already has a national debt of something like 30 trillion plus. UK is approaching 3 trillion. And people think, what is a trillion? You know, it's a million. You know, if you paid back somebody a million a year, it would take a million years to pay that back. And it's just going up and up and up. The only people who seem to benefit are, you know, arms manufacturers, companies involved in manufacturing for the war. And people do get rich during the war, but it's not ordinary taxpayers like us who get rich. We end up paying for it.
Indeed. Now, in some more sobering news, I mentioned the figures at the top of the hour, but the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights has called for an end to Israel's offensive in Gaza, highlighting that over 100,000 have already been killed or wounded since the start of the war 5 months ago. About one in every 20 children, women and men are now dead or wounded. At least 17,000 children are orphaned or separated from their families. This according to Volker Turk, who told a session of the Human Rights Council Justice in Geneva. Let's listen in.
There appear to be no bounds to, no words to capture the horrors that are unfolding before our eyes in Gaza. Since early October, over 100,000 people have been killed or wounded. Let me repeat that. About one in every 20 children, women and men, are now dead or wounded. At least 17,000 children are orphaned or separated from their families, while many more will carry the scars of physical and emotional trauma lifelong. The war in Gaza must end. Clear violations of international human rights and humanitarian laws, including war crimes and possibly other crimes under international law, have been committed. Almost all are drinking salty and contaminated water. Healthcare across the territory is barely functioning. Just imagine what this means for the wounded and for people suffering infectious disease outbreaks. In northern Gaza, where the operational space for humanitarian work is now almost zero, many are already believed to be starving.
Uzma, the UN rights chief, said, just as to almost echo your thoughts there earlier, where he says he's got no words here, and then went on to list a litany of crimes and manipulations and so on. But what are your thoughts when you hear the UN rights chief almost sounding as if he doesn't have the answers to these very difficult questions that have been posed by this genocide?
It's truly heartbreaking. You know, I've been asking this question from the beginning. Why were these laws created? Who has the authority to enforce them? How can this carry on and nothing happen? And I just think that the way Israel have been given the go-ahead from the rest of the world, especially the Western world, there is no other country in the world that would get away with it in the way that they have. So I think it's just one, this country specifically, that makes everyone feel so hopeless and helpless in this situation. But again, coming back to my optimistic state of being, I really would like to think that, you know, we've come to this extent that, you know, everybody's lost for words. What next? Like, how far can it go? I think the people power is so immense, and everybody's involved in one way or another. This will have to come to an end, but it is a very horrible situation to see the top of the top, the highest of the high people don't have words anymore. They don't know what to do or what to say. It's a very, very terrible situation.
And of course, Charles, you know, you're a man who is very attuned to your statistics, and some of the statistics that were wielded out there are almost beyond comprehension. How are you rationalizing what you're seeing and these different stats that are being thrown at you?
Yeah, it's unbelievable when you think they've passed the 30,000 mark of dead people. And it's a statistic to us, but to them these are 30,000 lives lost, families affected. There was a guy saying he'd lost 102 relatives, and there were, as this was announced, there were apparently Israelis were firing on people queuing for food and aid in the early hours of this morning. So, as Uzma said, where does it all end? It's got to end with talks, and America needs to step in and get this sorted out. I think they're the most influential country on Israel, and it's got to end soon.
Now we know that there is a current case about the occupation territories and the legitimacy thereof at the ICJ. Israel has already ignored that 1 month deadline for them to come back and report about how they are trying to prevent any kind of humanitarian further disasters taking place inside Gaza. Have we lost faith in those institutions? Because if they're not holding clear violations to account, what happens after that?
Yeah, I think there is some loss of faith in those institutions because these judgments, there's no enforcement of them. There's nobody enforcing these judgments. So I think there is a bit of loss of faith in these things. But at least it highlights that the problem, it brings it to the attention of the media and international countries, that some, you know, at least one organization is trying to stop it.
Uzma, we have so many different ideas about, you know, talking about the optimism here or where to go. When someone comes to you and say they're experiencing fatigue from just watching these images and experiencing this on a day-to-day basis, what is your feedback as a therapist on this?
It's going to be controversial, actually, and it goes completely against what I stand for, generally speaking, as an expert in somebody who likes to see people regulated and support them come out of their trauma and live a happy, content life. I think that the kind of world that we're living in right now, I think we should be disturbed. I think we should be having sleepless nights. I think we should be thinking about what's going on. And, you know, if we are going about our daily life like nothing has happened, that is a bigger problem to me. Having said that, I'm not advocating for people to burn themselves out. I'm not somebody who's going to push for that to happen. But I do think that there should be a level of unease and discomfort in your life right now, because what's happening is not normal, and it should not be perceived as normal, and it should not be seen as something, meh, it's just happening in another part of the world, because this affects every single one of us, and it should shake the core of who we are and what we've believed in so far. And that's where the hope comes in, right? Because we're saying that we've lost hope in these big organizations like the UN and the ICJ and all of those, you know, where did they come from? They came from a World War II, which is, you know, everything had been lost, the way it had been conducted. They understood that that's not how we want to see things continue. This is going to yet bring another layer of, we never want to see this happen, so hopefully it's going to wake people up. But if we numb ourselves, and if we don't have the emotions, and if we don't look at what's happening, and if we don't bear witness, we're basically not going to equip people in the future to make the changes that are necessary. The youth are going to be so disconnected from what's happening. So I think it's important and very necessary to feel the pain. And we're not even feeling the fraction. We're just watching. That's all we're doing. If we start to understand what they are going through, it's unfathomable what's going to take for them to come out. I'm sure we will survive it.
A small price to pay, but one we must pay nonetheless, Uzma. Well, just a reminder here that this is Gaza Under Attack. We take a deep dive into some of the talking points surrounding the ongoing U.S.-Israeli genocidal war on Gaza, the blockaded coastal enclave. Now, the head of the Palestine mission to the UK, Dr. Hussam Zomlot, told the press in London this week that the state of Palestine has put forward a comprehensive plan for a ceasefire and the way forward, but this cannot be achieved if Israel doesn't allow an enabling environment.
This government is offered by the state of Palestine by way of uniting our people and our geography, and providing for our immense, unprecedented needs. But that government will not be able to do so without creating an enabling environment for that government. That government cannot be formed or functioning If a person like Smotrich, who happened to be the finance minister of Israel, keeps deciding, should we be receiving our own money or not? Our money, our taxes. That government cannot function, should we still have all the crippling checkpoints and walls that has torn apart our economy and shrinked our economic base. That government cannot function if we still have no control over our resources, natural resources, land and what have you. That government will not be able to function if we do not have control of our borders. So we create our own and conduct our own international trade agreements, like any other government. Of course, the government will have to levy, will have to create its own revenue base. And those are the revenue bases. International help will go in the form of programs, programs that will help in the reconstruction, what have you. But our budget has to come from our revenues. So it is crucial, it is absolutely crucial that we make sure that the new government is enabled. And this is the discussion, this is the conversation we are having with our regional and international partners. And we are presenting all these partners with clear plan and way forward of how a new government can function and can deliver.
Voting has kicked off in the Rochdale by-election in England. It's the first major test of voters' intentions since the start of the US-Israeli genocide on the people of Gaza. Pro-Palestine candidate George Galloway is tipped to win by the bookmakers, but ahead of the count, we spoke with him and asked what would be his first task if elected.
The first thing I'm going to do is, on Wednesday, Prime Minister's questions, I'm going to tell the Prime Minister that I have arrived with a fresh mandate, the only member of the House to do so, with a fresh mandate to stop the slaughter in Gaza. A ceasefire is necessary, but not sufficient. A temporary pause, a humanitarian pause, a simple ceasefire is not enough. We need an end to the occupation. We need the total withdrawal of the siege of Gaza. And we need recognition of the Palestinian right to self-determination, enshrined in international law, enshrined in Security Council resolutions, enshrined in the Oslo Agreement, all ignored. And the Oslo Agreement is now dead and buried. It's been ignored for so long. 700,000 illegal settlers are now living on the parts of Palestine that were supposed to be the Palestinian state. So 30 years since the Oslo Agreement, it's time to raise the flag of one state, call it the Holy Land, in which Jews, Muslims and Christians live as equal citizens before the law. These are the kind of arguments I'll be making in Parliament.
George Galloway there. So we have a few more minutes to go. Let's continue the conversation with my guests, Charles Kelly and Uzba Naqvi. And Charles there, we saw the this by-election in Rochdale. It's a real litmus test to see how politicians, how voters, how prospective voters are responding to the issue of Palestine and Gaza and the way politicians have dealt with this. How do you see this playing out?
It was very interesting how it's worked out for George. I mean, George is a wily old experienced campaigner. He's been an MP before. He was a Labour MP in Scotland. So he knows what he's doing. But this is almost like this is falling in his lap because of Labour's withdrawal of support for their candidate, although it still appears as a Labour candidate on the ballot. So maybe some people will just vote Labour. But he's...
Isn't that problematic, though? The fact that for a man who's been essentially disavowed by his own party, he's still on the ballot because it was too late to take him off, but almost by some kind of conditioning, people will still tick the box because that's how politics sometimes works here.
Yeah, I guess people go into the box and just, oh, tick Labour. I usually vote Labour. So it's very close. George is the favourite, but only by a narrow margin. But it could cause a big upset if he wins. Whether he'll stay in power for very long, if there's a general election towards the end of the year, he could have a very short term.
Why do you say that?
Well, because Labour could come back and win in the general election. In by-elections, sitting parties can often lose a by-election more or less as a protest vote. But in the general election, where there's a higher turnout, more people are out on the streets in the general election, usually the seat can go back to the previous party. It could happen. I'm not saying it would happen, but George will certainly shake things up if he gets into Parliament. I'm sure he'll have a few words to say to the government.
I can almost see Richie Sunak and Sir Keir Starmer going, "Oh no, not him! We thought we'd escaped him.
Yeah, they got rid of him now, and he's back. He's like he won't go away."
Uzma, you know, we've talked here about politicians with a pro-Palestine agenda doing quite well so far in some of this. But what do you make of the people power that's brought them to where they are right now? Because we've been out on our streets in the tens of thousands here, in the millions, some would say.
Yeah, I mean, it's our only hope. It's the only reason that I feel any optimism that I do. Rochdale, especially what you're just discussing right now, has a very large Asian community, Muslim community, who are hugely disappointed in the way that, you know, things have turned out with Labour. And I think that it's a refreshing change. It's George Galloway is one of my favorite people. I can listen to him for hours. He's somebody who's unapologetic about his views, and this is something that's happening right now, and it needs to be dealt with right now. So we need somebody who has the strength to be able to relay a message. And I was smiling just there when you came to me, because you're absolutely right, because both the government right now and the opposition are going to be hitting their foreheads when they see George Galloway appear, because he's somebody who has a lot of strength in what he says. He goes with his numbers. He has his facts and figures. He's a very strong person. And I think it's important to have people like that, to, you know, who can be our voice and who can speak what we want to say, because we don't have access to the powers that be. I myself have been a supporter of Labour for a very, very long time, and I can't remember ever voting any other party, but it will never happen again. I mean, that's how much people feel such a disappointment that they have completely failed us on the views that we hold as constituents. So I think it's really important to have more voices like this. But I'm certainly very happy that things are evolving in the way that they are. It's very disappointing also to see Keir Starmer and the way that he has dealt with this whole thing and the whole suspensions and everything else. And the very reason that they took Jeremy Corbyn out is also the very reason that his own members within his own party, it's just created such a big mess. And I do think that this will change, bring up a refreshing change, inshallah. I do see it being better.
Indeed. Thank you so much, Charles Kelly and Uzma Naqvi. Great words to leave it there. And thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with us. And for you, until we meet again, continue to keep Palestine in your hearts.
The Limelight.
A Palestinian woman who was abducted by Zionist regime forces from a school in the Gaza Strip recalls her harrowing experience in detention. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote, sexual abuse, beatings, yelling, deprivation of food, lack of medical care, and psychological torment. This was life in the Zionist regime detention for Amene Hussein. The Palestinian mother of three was abducted by the Zionist regime forces from her place of refuge in the war-torn Gaza Strip in late December.
For over 40 days, she was held in unimaginable conditions. She is one of the hundreds of Palestinian women, girls, men, and elders who have been arbitrarily detained by invading Israeli regime troops throughout the ongoing assault. They are held in incommunicado with the Zionist regime troops, taking them to unknown locations and providing no information about their whereabouts. Hussein was one of the lucky few who made it out. The following account is based on an interview she gave to the Middle East Eye, in which she recalls her harrowing experience in the Zionist regime's detention. Amena Hussein lived in Gaza City with her two daughters, aged 13 and 12, and her son, aged 6. 4 days after the war started on October 7th, her sister joined them in the house after her home was bombed. For nearly a month, they lived under the horrifying sounds of relentless nearby air strikes. The city, home to nearly 1 million people before the war, had come under a bombing campaign seen as among the most destructive in recent history, proportionally causing more damage than that of the Allied bombing of Germany in the Second World War. Desperate for a sense of safety, Amina Hussein left with her three children to take shelter at a school in Gaza. But that wasn't enough. Hussein told MEE, "The army kept obsessively calling my mobile phone and asking everyone to leave the school," she said. "I gathered my children and went seeking refuge at a school in the central Gaza Strip in the Nuseirat area, but it was so unbelievably crowded that we couldn't find a place to stand up, let alone sit or sleep. I ended up walking around the schools, looking for a safe place for my children until we found a school to stay in at the Al-Waraj refugee camp. I stayed there for the next 8 days. On the 9th day, the school was bombed by the Israeli army, although they knew it was sheltering displaced women, children, and the entire families. Thank God, my children and I survived the bombing. Next, I sought shelter."